Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guests on this episode are Brad Tolinsky and Chris Gill. They are the authors of Blow by Blow, the Jeff Beck story, which is out now. The book examines the life and music of the legendary guitarist from his formative years to his final moments, drawing on interviews from friends and collaborators such as Jimmy Page, Johnny Depp, Clive Davis, and many others. Tolinsky and Gill, who are following up their best-selling work, Eruption, Conversations with Eddie Van Halen, recently discussed their goals in writing Blow by Blow, some of the revelations they encountered in the process, and how Jeff Beck distinguished himself from his peers and admirers. That's Brad Tolinsky and Chris Gill discussing their new book, Blow by Blow, The Jeff Beck Story, on Into Music, coming up now. There were some Jeff Beck books out there, but you really wanted to dive a little bit deeper, right, going into this project.
Definitely. Yeah, I think I'll let Brad explain too, but we're coming on hot off of another review, which does mention some of the other books. And our thing was to be comprehensive, but not all the details. I mean, first of all, it's a book. We have a finite amount of space. So we needed to concentrate on what was really important here. And we felt that the other books had a tendency to be just like a timeline and read like that. Jeff did this, and then Jeff did this, and then Jeff did this, and then Jeff did that. And our goal was to really cover big points, at least what we as authors thought were the big points, the milestones in his career, but also get the insight behind what happened. What was Jeff thinking? How was he feeling? What motivated him? What inspired him? Why did these things happen? It's easy to just list things, you know, and say he did this and that, but really to get behind it and to give a clearer picture of who this guy was as a human being and as a musician, you know, and his role in this wider world of ours.
You know, I think the fault of most rock bios is they work too hard to be comprehensive and then lose sight of the story. You know, the idea for our book is we wanted to create a compelling narrative to explain what this guy was doing. We didn't want to get lost in the details. We wanted to get behind the how and the why more than every last micro detail of, you know, what Jeff was. We wanted to get into the psychology of it and why he did the things that he did.
And he kind of breaks the typical, you know, the biopic mode, where it's like, here's this rise to fame, here's this fall from grace, and here's the redemption. Jeff doesn't have that arc. He has 1,000 arcs, you know, and they can be mind-boggling and confusing. And it was our task to make sense of all that and to find those lines where they applied in his life and to maybe ignore the things that were just like, you know, a paycheck for him. You know, but to find those things that are really important to him and what was important to us, what was important to the wider audience and to the music world in general.
Yeah. I see Jeff's career as a constant evolution. It's not, the typical, as Chris was saying, biopic arc. It wasn't, you know, a rise and a fall and rise. It was sort of a constant growth. And maybe that's not quite as sexy, but musically, it's fascinating.
What came to mind was the word seeker and the way that jazz players are seekers, that this is an evolution. This is a timeline, and I'm going to fill it with different flavors and colors along the way.
In many ways, Jeff, in terms of his attitude towards music, was more like a jazz guy. He wasn't a jazz musician per se, but the typical rock and roll story is one of gangs, you know, of bands that get together and stay together for 20, 30 years or whatever. And Jeff Beck was more like, I'm evolving as a musician and I need to find other musicians that are in the same headspace or can evolve with me. So there was a constant change. There was a shifting of bands. There were different musicians that sort of come in and out. And that was by design, not by accident. Sometimes Jeff wanted to go in a funk direction, and so we needed to find guys that did that and created one of the first really racially integrated bands in the 70s, with his second edition of the Jeff Beck Group. And then later he wanted to go harder or heavier, and he found Tim Bogert and Carmen Appice when he did the Beck Bogert Peace record. Sometimes he wanted to go world music and ethereal, and he had to find the right players for that kind of thing. So in that way, he was very much a seeker, much more like a jazz musician than he was your traditional rock musician.
He was very much a mercurial loner. When I went to go interview him for the first time, his manager, Ralph Baker, kind of set me up and said, Jeff's really excited to talk about this. And when, Ralph knew that I was into rockabilly and had a lot of information about Cliff Gallup, who was his guitar hero, which, Ralph had actually done some seeking of his own and tried to reach Cliff in the day. So I was excited showing up, and then we get there and he's locked us out, And my greeting to him was he opened the door and promptly turned his back on me. It was just like he had this oasis out in, south of London, 80 acres of property, with this beautiful 1500s era house smack dab in the middle of it where he could escape from people. And I think he really enjoyed this isolation of sorts, which is actually kind of ironic because later in his life, him and Johnny Depp did this song Isolation, where they're bemoaning the whole COVID crisis and having to be away from human contact. And it's like, Jeff, you lived your entire life avoiding human contact, But yeah, he was really, he's kind of a mysterious guy. But once you crack the surface, he's quite an excellent person too.
Well, I love too that while there is some decoding and examination of motivations and so forth, in the end, there still is that mystique that's still there via the book, and I think that's appropriate. I think I think some of that enigmatic nature was intentional, and it's very respectful to maintain that.
Yes, it's and that's who he was, really. I mean, he was a mysterious figure. Part of the thing is some things we didn't know about, and that's why we dug out with other people. And if we had just sat down with Jeff to get these stories alone, we probably wouldn't have gotten as much insight as we did. It really took some of these other people that came and went in his life to provide a different perspective on it. And a lot of times to just fact check things and to either verify or to debunk, what happened. And that was really an important part of the process for us was, doing that digging around after the fact. And some stuff was just, stuff we had sitting by the wayside, stuff that never went into print, like an interview I did with Steve Lukather about this failed album project that they did together in the late 90s. That just was a conversation I had on the side when I was talking to Lukather about something else, but here it perfectly fit the piece into the puzzle.
Yeah, I mean, I think the paradox of Jeff Beck and his career, which is interesting in itself, is that he became this sort of globally recognized stadium-filling icon, but somehow he still managed to maintain the sort of cool of an underground cult hero. And I think that that was the key to the longevity of his career. He never embarrassed himself. He always had a tremendous amount of taste in what he would do and what he would release. And I think in the book, Chris and I explained that there was almost as much recorded material that he didn't release as he did release, because his standards, his personal standards of what he wanted out there, were so high. And so on occasion, he would get the bad reputation for being a difficult guy. But it was always him pursuing a state of excellence. It wasn't really just him having a bad attitude or being a bad guy.
And what's so fascinating about him is Brad had spoken with Clive Davis not too long before he passed away. And, Clive gave him this amazing 10 album contract, which was unheard of then, is unheard of now. And the fact that they believed in him that much, they gave him that. And then he delivered in the most unpredictable way with Blow by Blow and Wired. Here's the last thing that Epic expected to be a success, and it was a success. And then you go on to the other side of that where they decide to meddle with his career and they do Flash, and that bombs horribly. And I think
His
it
most
was,
commercial project, is the biggest flop.
And it was interesting because that it was almost to his own benefit that that didn't happen, because he didn't go, like, we did a book on Van Halen before, and Van Halen reached a point later in their career where their record label turned down a follow-up album twice. And Jeff never had the record label say, like, no, we're not releasing that. It was Jeff who said, I'm not releasing this. So, and that's a very unusual position again for him to be in, because a lot of times it's just like you're doing this album we're putting out regardless of what you think. But they let Jeff have the ultimate say about this, and that's unusual and phenomenal. And then the industry rewards him with all these Grammys, which is actually much more than his contemporaries. I think only Eric Clapton has more Grammys as a guitar player figure. Whether it's Jimmy Page or Jimi Hendrix, or whether it's someone more contemporary like Steve Vai or Joe Satriani, it's phenomenal that the industry really embraced him.
I want to talk about Stevie Wonder, because it seems to me that there are a couple of times where Beck has these sort of contemporaries, but they're also muses. And I feel like Stevie Wonder was that function for him.
That's a great observation. Yes. So in the early 70s, Jeff gets into a terrible car accident that sidelines him. And actually, he was close to death. He was thrown out of a car and hit the pavement and split his head open. And he's forced to, just pull the plug on his career and go back and rethink everything. And during this period, he always loved Motown, but he really embraces R&B music during this period. It just sounds good to him. He's not interested in loud and heavy rock because it basically hurts his brain. And he really falls in love with the music of Stevie Wonder. He sees Stevie as one of the great geniuses of that time. And so he approaches Stevie to produce one of his records. Stevie's career was going off like a rocket at that time and couldn't take out the time. But they saw sort of this mutually beneficial relationship. Stevie could help Jeff cross over to a black R&B audience, and Jeff could help Stevie cross over to the white rock crowd. So they strike a deal, a fascinating deal, for Jeff to play on Stevie's record and for Stevie to write some songs for Jeff, and one of those is Superstition.
Heck of a tune.
One heck of a tune, yeah. And what happens with that is, you can read all the details, because we devote a chapter to in the book to that alone, which is, that, again, that's was part of our thing, because it's like it would be just easy to say, like, Stevie wrote Superstition for Jeff, and then they decided to record it himself, and boom, end of story. But no, there's much more to it than that. There's a lot more to it than that. And it's interesting too, that period, because that automobile accident really, again, this is another thing that we explore in the book, of just what effect that had on his career. Again, it wasn't just an event that happened. He got waylaid for a year. He goes in this rock funk direction and soul R&B, but at the same time, he's absorbing fusion music. He when he's actually working on his hot rod that he wrecked and trying to put it back together, he hears Miles Davis, the Jack Johnson, the tribute to Jack Johnson album with John McLaughlin on guitar on the BBC. And he's like, wait a second, this is amazing. And he's mesmerized by it. And that starts the kind of the side fascination. And he sidetracks for 5 years, essentially. And that's what leads to Blow by Blow and him working with George Martin and all this other stuff, because he's following John McLaughlin and the Mahavishnu Orchestra. And of course, listening to all this other music, where he finds out about Jan Hammer, who plays a role throughout his career after that. Jan comes and goes at all these key points in Jeff's career. And if it hadn't been for that automobile accident, that may not have happened.
Yeah, I think as you point out, Jeff finds these muses, whether it's Miles Davis or whether it's Stevie Wonder. And the interesting thing is, it's rarely another guitar player. It's these guys that play trumpet, or Stevie that plays keyboard, or the jazz keyboardist Jan Hammer. And it's very rarely a guitar player that grabs him and And I think that ends up making his guitar playing different, unique from his peers and his contemporaries, because he's thinking about the guitar in terms of these other sorts of musicians.
And it's later in his career, it becomes his voice. It becomes a voice. It's like a voice. I mean, he listens to the Bulgarian State Women's Choir. You know, that becomes a big inspiration on him. And he's copying their inflections, and he goes on to imitating an Indian vocalist as well, and all these things that he listens to. And opera, Luciano Pavarotti. You know, he does Nessun Dorma. One of the famous aria. And it's just amazing how he could really, literally, make his guitar sing.
I want to talk about that element of the playing, but to talk about Blow by Blow and Wired, he did something with those records that I find fascinating, which is he took that music and made it accessible. I love Mahavishnu Orchestra and Al Di Meola, but they don't have, I think, that same mainstream appeal that those two records possess.
Well, even Jeff sort of admits as much. You know, he says that he felt like one of his great accomplishments is he loved the music of Miles Davis, and he loved the music of John McLaughlin and the fusion artists like Mahavishnu Orchestra and Return to Forever. But he said probably the great part of Blow by Blow and Wired is that he was able to take that music, take the essence of that music, and make it accessible to a wider audience. And I think he was proud of that.
He definitely was very proud of it, and I think it was part of where he was coming from, because he did have this, you know, he was a rock musician first and foremost, you know, who was entering the jazz world, whereas with McLaughlin, he was a jazz musician entering the rock world. So the understanding was a bit different. And you know, the funny thing about Blow by Blow is it often gets categorized as this jazz rock fusion, but it's a lot more funky than that. It's really jazz funk fusion, and the rock part doesn't really start to come until Wired a bit. And I think they just kind of put those two albums together because there is a shift that's going on there. But and the other thing about Jeff that was just amazing was because he could condense something and get the most out of, you know, they talk about blues players and being able to hit you with one note, you know. Well, that was Jeff completely. You know, he could take three notes and work out the best way, even though it could be an incredibly simple melody. You know, and other people can play it, but they don't get that personality and that phrasing and that feeling, that emotion through that he does. And it's just three simple notes sometimes, and he would work to death on that and just study and study, whereas most players would be like, oh, that's good enough, I'll just move on. I'll move on to
Yeah.
where I get to really shred really fast, you know.
I think it's important to make the distinction is that Jeff wasn't dumbing down jazz to make it accessible.
No.
He was just bringing his sensibility to jazz music. He was under no illusions that he was a jazz player. He was a rock player, but there was something about the playing and the phrasing of somebody like Miles Davis that he loved, that he wanted to bring into the rock world. Yeah, Blow by Blow, I mean, as we're talking about it, I was thinking it really is a combination of the Motown music that he loved, of that sort of funky Stevie Wonder sound, sort of melded with the atmospheric instrumental beauty of a Miles Davis or John McLaughlin.
I want to talk about his approach to his instrument in the way of, I was watching clips, one of them being from the Secret Policeman's Ball and then Ronnie Scott's. And his relationship to his instrument is one that I don't see in a lot of rock players. He had this concentration that's almost like a classical player.
As a music writer, my personal revelation was while I was studying especially the later part of his career, I play classical violin as well as I play guitar, so I started plugging into this. But the way Jeff would approach music, especially in the later, again, the later part of his career, he would approach it almost like a classical musician, whereas that every note mattered dynamically. And his phrasing, he would think about that stuff quite a bit.
I think the other part for me, the important part is that he didn't view the guitar as guitar. Like, these are the frets. This is how you play. This is guitar technique. he heard a sound in his head. And of course, this comes from all these other sources that he was listening to. And he would figure out a way to pull that sound out of the guitar. And that starts very early on, whether it's with the Yardbirds doing a train whistle at the beginning of Train Kept a Rollin', or sirens on Happenings 10 Years Time Ago, or a sitar on Heart Full of Soul. And that continues on throughout his career, barking dogs and cats on Ain't Superstition with the Jeff Beck Group. Then you take that up to, again, Where Were You, like I mentioned, and the Bulgarian State Television Women's Choir, where he's imitating that. And that's, I think, that was the essence of it for me, was because I saw him a lot. I saw him numerous times, probably a dozen times, on the 1995 tour with Carlos Santana, but also with Stevie Ray Vaughan, on that tour they did in 1989, where he performed Where Were You every night. And I realized that, a lot of a Jeff Beck show is a lot of posturing, just like any other rock guitar person, fist in the air, bold movements and everything, guitar up and everything like that. But then when it comes to Where Were You, he stops in place and he hunches over the instrument. And it's just like the lightest of touch. And he's manipulating the volume control and the tone control and this, the tremolo bar that has to be moved precisely to hit those notes right on. And he has to hit these harmonics, which require a light touch as well. So it's the exact opposite of that. And so much rock guitar is just machismo, and it's playing really forcefully and hard and big, grand movements and everything for an arena. And here he was in an arena, everything quiets and he's doing this thing and he's pulling it off. And that was just amazing. And it's just a complete mind shift. And that's what he really brought to the guitar, was that he didn't see these limitations, or this standard way of playing. And it was just like, I hear a sound and I'm going to pursue that and get it no matter what.
In watching the Ronnie Scott's material, the way that he's maneuvering sometimes with the whammy bar, you think of it as, a lot of people just grab it and his delicacy with it, so that it's just a flavor. It's not something outrageous. It's like that has, like we were saying, the note.
Well, it's kind of like being almost like an Indian musician, where he's able to manipulate the bar and get microtones out of things, but not just this sort of the gross bending of notes. It's the tiniest of movements to create emotion, as a much in, that's mu that's in Indian music, basically.
And it goes back to even back to Cliff Gallup, with Gene Vincent, where he would do these solos and he'd depress the bar just before and raise into the note a little bit. And it just gives it that little bit of that vocal inflection, like, okay, I'm a singer and I'm trying to find the note. And it's like, oh, I'm a little bit flat. Let me pull up,
For me, the real revelation in his career was the Loud Hailer album. I adored that when it came out. I thought it was such a interesting collection of songs, performances. And this is also this era where he is focused on working a lot with women musicians.
Well, I always say, as much as he was musically ahead of his time, he was also a little culturally ahead of his time, and doesn't get enough recognition or credit for that. I mean, it starts in the 60s, where he's an advocate for animal rights and becomes a vegetarian. And then in the 70s, he has one of the first racially integrated rock bands. It's hard to believe, but it was very, very unusual for a white rock musician to have a black lead singer. And then later on in the 90s and 2000s, he really champions women musicians. But he does so in a very subtle, not in any sort of overt kind of way. In fact, he was always reluctant to draw too much attention to that. He just did it. He brought in great women bass players, great women guitar players. And but it's interesting, Jeff, in one of the times I talked to him, sort of said that working on cars, which he was famous for working on his hot rods, was sort of his masculine energy. And he saw music as being an expression of his more feminine energy. And so he felt very comfortable working with women in that context. And it wasn't just, oh, the lead singer, or for some sort of woke recognition. He just really felt that it was women that would really contribute and make that part of his music stronger and better.
And I think it was the overall energy that female musicians bring too, because, male musicians can come with a lot of ego and baggage and tension. And I think he'd been through so much of that, of fighting with other musicians over things. And sometimes it may just be a little thing that triggered him off. And he found that women were much easier to work with. But it was just also, he just thought they were great. I mean, Jennifer Batten was one of the first women musicians to enter his world, basically. And they met in 92. And when she was on tour with Michael Jackson, came by to visit and everything. And they just bonded. They got along really well. And it's really fascinating because Jeff was not one to have a second guitarist in his band either. And Jennifer gets brought in, and then becomes a whole slew of these other guitarists, working with him from that point on, which was fascinating. But I think he just really liked the energy and being around that. And even there was a period there with initially with Jennifer, the first band he got together was with Tony Levin and Terry Bozzio. And that was the rhythm section, a phenomenal rhythm section. I would have loved to have heard what they did. But Terry got cold feet, thinking like, oh, Jeff's burned me before and I'm just going to bail. And he brought Tony with him. But Jennifer stuck it out. And I think that shows you a lot about, again, that dynamic that he had. The guys were just, a little bit trigger happy, so to speak, and were w willing to leave at a moment's notice if anything didn't seem right with Jeff. Whereas Jennifer was like, okay, I can go through this and I can nurture this and make something happen with it.
He found the better collaborators. I mean, yeah.
Speaking of cars, one of the things that you dispel in the book is this idea that he spent all this time kind of wandering in the wilderness, if you will, working on cars, abandoned music, blah, blah, blah. But he was making music that whole time. He was doing sessions. He had projects that were never released. As always, the cars were just another facet of life.
Well, he often used the time working on cars to think about his music, because he thought he felt like that was important creative time as well, just listening and thinking and considering it rather than always doing. And I think in many ways it's a much healthier outlet too. I mean, you cannot be playing music 24/7. It's just difficult, especially with the level of concentration that he brings to it. You need some time away. And I think that that's where most rock stars got into trouble. The time away from music was spent doing other things that weren't particularly healthy, And, Jeff used this working on cars as sort of his something to do when he wasn't playing the guitar rather than going out and partying until 3 in the morning or something like that.
It was a passion for him. It was a huge passion. I mean, he built almost 20 hot rods. That's a lot of cars. That's a lot of work. But at the same time, it wasn't necessarily a priority. And I think music remained a priority. And it was just, I would, hear from his domestic partners how Jeff would be out in the garage and come in all covered in grease and oil, for dinner or whatever. And he'd walk in the door, and the first thing he'd do is pick up a guitar, and start noodling. And then he'd sit there with a guitar in his lap while he's eating his meal. He'd sit there with the guitar in his lap while he's watching television. That's just, again, it shows that he was constantly working on it. So that, he loved guitars. It's funny though, because he really treasured his cars and pampered them, polished them, and kept them nice and spick and span. But his guitars were just abused. They were just tools. It was like the wrench that he used, to remove, spark plugs or whatever to him. It was just there was no, no like, oh, this is my precious. No. This is where Nigel Tufnel gets it wrong in Spinal Tap. It's like he didn't have any guitar that's good. No, you can't look at that. You can't touch that. None of that. So Jeff was like, yeah, go ahead and take it and throw it in the swamp if you want. I don't care.
The music was his the great finished product. Was the thing of beauty. The guitar was a tool to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. Mechanics aren't too precious about their drills and wrenches. So
No. They're replaceable. You wear them out, you replace them. And when I first met Jeff, he took me up to the attic and showed me his guitars, and I saw the ox blood, which was just like, oh my gosh, and then I saw it and it's like, man, it's covered in a thick layer of dust. It's dirty. The strings are rusty. It's
This
like
guitar that's probably worth like
it's the one that's on the cover of
$3 or
Blow by Blow
something.
on the Blow by Blow album. Yeah, it sold for over $1 million. It was the first Les Paul. In fact, I think it still may to this day be the only Les Paul that sold for more than $1 million. But to Jeff, it was just like, ah, that's a relic. I gave up on that, back in 1976. And there it sat in its attic, in his attic, collecting dust. I didn't come up and polish it or anything or put it in a case. It was just like sitting on the stand. Yeah.
I know that when you research something, you're writing about it, you sometimes turn those corners and you come upon the unexpected. What were the really powerful moments like that in this process?
I think for me, it was like it came from the other people we interviewed. Some of it was just going back, like mentioning about that Tony Levin and Terry Bozzio thing, and then talking with Jennifer Batten about that, because it was an offhanded remark that Jeff made to me when I interviewed him that first time, because we had a 3-hour conversation, and he just actually, I'm sorry, that was 1999, because that was later. That was a 1999 thing, but he just kind of made an offhanded remark about that. But talking with Simon Phillips in particular for me, this period of the early 80s, which is one of those periods where journalists kind of lazily said, like, Jeff just worked on his hot rods and didn't do anything. He did a ton of stuff, and Simon completely laid that out. And I think there's some of the funniest things, in the book, because it's just like these stories are just like, wow, it's just like, I never knew this before. And I read all the other books, I read all the interviews and everything, and I never knew about this period and this project, this album project. And it's fascinating. Yes, it didn't go anywhere, but man, does it give you an insight into just what was going on in this turmoil? The 80s, things changed. The 70s were dead, and just everyone's trying to find their way. And that for me was like, I think, one of the big things. But there was many little things like that throughout the book. There was just, it's sprinkled with, I think, people who think they know a lot about Jeff Beck are going to discover a lot of new stuff, because we did.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think two things stand out that surprised me or, added a lot of layers onto his story that I didn't really know before. One was that because he looked great, everybody assumed that he was the picture of health. And I found out, several things that happened to him during the course of his career that affected his career. That affected his attitude. On three different occasions, he had split his head open, and he had accident when he was a child riding on a bike, and got concussed when a car hit him. And then later on, he was sick and fell down some steps, and again had a head injury, and then got into a terrible car accident. Same thing, and this created a situation where he would have terrible headaches. I think later contributed to having tinnitus. And having to deal with that sort of physical ailment while you're in the rigors of touring, especially in the early days when things were really tough, affected his attitude on a whole bunch of things, made him a little disagreeable, whereas where he got his reputation. So, finding out these accidents or physical ailments and how they affected his career and his attitude about things was a revelation to me. I think the other thing was I always had heard rumors about him recording a record at Motown, and I heard little bits and pieces of it. And I was being a Detroit boy, and I was very curious about this. And I was able to dig out a lot of information about that. And it did turn out to be a pivotal moment in his career. He went to Motown. It wasn't a very successful outing, which we tell in the book. He ran into cultural differences and clashes with the other Motown musicians. And he did record almost a whole album there, but was not satisfied with the results. But it influenced him in many other ways, as we previously discussed. It sort of made him double down on this idea of going in this R and B direction, but it just wasn't going to happen at Motown.
Yeah. It's funny because talking about the injuries and the illnesses, because I had talked with him a few times, and again, when you're in the midst of it, you don't think much of it. Oh, he just got sick. But when you see the string of things, and when you put it all together like we did, it is does become quite revelatory, and real you realize what an impact it had, because he told me about having this sickness that was, related to Legionnaires' disease, and like he went out to go wash his car and, nearly passed out. And you realize that, wow, he had these things, and that's it, you think of all the other his contemporaries who are still kicking. Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, Keith Richards, they abused themselves pretty damn badly. Jeff took care of himself pretty good. I mean, he had his, he liked to drink a bit and everything, but generally, vegetarian lifestyle, keeping a 28-inch waist, his entire lifetime and everything. He did seem to project this picture of health. And then to realize, gosh, maybe he wasn't as healthy as we thought. And then to lose him as suddenly as we did. It's kind of like it was a shock at first, but then it was almost like a wow, it's a good thing it didn't happen earlier.
Yeah, I think reading the book, I understood, because when he passed, I was like, "What?" I mean, come on, he was like he had just been on the road, right?
He was playing, and he was playing amazingly well. He was at peak form. Jeff never slipped in talent or capability. He just kept on getting better up until the very end, which is why it was a shock. He was out on this tour that was doing very well with Johnny Depp, and he was playing amazingly. And then the next thing you know, he's gone. Just phew, like that. And I kind of liken it to the War of the Worlds. At least that's how it felt at first. It was like this big space alien being taken out by this tiny little virus, But we now realize it's a little bit more than that. It was kind of this ongoing struggle that he had, and he maybe wasn't as strong as he seemed. But to me, that's what it seemed like. It seemed like the giant was taken down by this little speck of, micro dust.
It's one thing to write a book, but then when you have prose that is as great as the prose here, where you can go back and read it again, that's a feat. How did you two learn how to write so well?
We argue with each other, and we just go like, "You're boring me, dude." I mean, that's what Brad did to me. I mean, the initial chapter that I wrote, he criticized, and rightfully so. And that we push each other to do things. I like to inject a lot of humor into my writing whenever I can, but at the same time, I like to inform. I'm also a fact and details guy, and I can get a little bit bogged down in the details. And it's like I've got to figure out a way to keep this, lively and keep people engaged without losing them. So whether it's to inject, and Jeff is a great source of quotable quotes. He's also very good at deflecting through his quotes. But it was kind of, it was, we were each other's biggest critics.
Yeah, that definitely helped. And I think and thank you so much for the compliment about the writing. I think both Chris and I come from a magazine background, and there's a certain discipline in that you have to convey a lot of information in a couple of thousand words, and you have to entertain.
Yes.
You can't be boring and sell magazines. So I sort of attribute it to that. I mean, I always think about, you want to convey information, but you also want to, entertain that audience. And I think not coming necessarily from the book world and coming from the magazine world, that was very helpful.
Yeah. It's funny because I very early on in my career, I got this horrible assignment to do. I was at Guitar Player Magazine. I got assigned to do a NAMM show report, which is this big convention of musical instrument manufacturers and all their new products. And it's basically, in the past, they've all been just a big, long laundry list of product after product after product and spec after spec after spec. And I said, God, I can't get into doing this. So I decided to do a spoof of Hunter Thompson's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas instead. And kind of wrote around, you were at this convention and all this weird stuff is happening, and I would just weave product into that, and it pissed off a lot of the old school guys, because they said, just tell us what the product is and everything like that. But I said, well, at least you read it, because you know what, I can't remember the last time I read one of those things myself, in a magazine.
I mean, and to that point, exactly, you could get bogged down in guitar nerd details. And it was very important for us to figure out a way. Obviously, the guitar is going to be central to a Jeff Beck story, but how do you write about this instrument and this technical stuff in a way that's going to engage a general reader? And that was forefront in our mind.
But at the
One
same
day,
time, we had to inform our own readerships, our own fans who have been with us since Guitar World, and we had to inject the pedals that he used and the amps that he used and the gear. We had to do that without like making people's eyes glaze over.
one way we did it sort of for your listeners out there that might be curious. The one way we sort of cut it both ways was we realized that we needed to include a certain amount of technical guitar information. So we took and put that in the in a handy dandy little guitar discography, if you will, in the back of the back of the book. So it's there for those who want to completely guitar nerd out on Jeff Beck. You'll get that, but
And
we
it's still
took it
not
out of
dry though. There's still stories in
the
there. There's still stories in that guitar section that I recommend that people think, oh, I don't want to read about boring guitar stuff. But there's some little interesting tidbits. I mean, Jeff, the famous guitar on the cover of Wired, this white Stratocaster, to this day nobody knows which one it was because Jeff had three. And what happened, well, two of them got stolen. And that's it's funny to read about how they got stolen because one was just, typical. Corruption, and the other one was just like Jeff being kind of airheaded, So, and there's a few things like that in there that it's, and it gives it a little bit of an interesting insight into his own search too, as well.
Well, on the always quotable Jeff Beck, I always think of the quote about Rod Stewart. We have a love-hate relationship. He loves me, and I hate him.
It sums it up, doesn't it?
For me, that my favorite quote, and that was during the interview I did with them, and it's been used a lot by other people, is like, "I'm an awkward son of a bitch when it comes to doing the expected."
I'll give you another one. One of my favorite Jeff Beck quotes in the book was, "I don't care about the rules. In fact, if I don't break the rules at least 10 times in every song, I'm not doing my job properly." And that says a lot about Jeff as well.
Well, is there anything I didn't touch on that either of you feel or both of you feel is important to mention?
I don't think so. I will say that we got quite a pleasant surprise a couple days ago. We got an early review in the London Telegraph, which is a very respected newspaper, that called this the best rock book of the year. And I think Chris and I are always a little afraid that people are just going to think that this book is going to be just a bunch of boring guitar stories. I think what the point that we would really like to get across is that we tried to create a compelling story with a real narrative drive. And, it's got all that stuff that you want in it, all the detail and the guitar stuff, but it's done within, I think, a pretty entertaining story.
Yeah, anyway, I think we were respectful but critical at the same time. We were willing to call him out to the map and say, like, Jeff, you screwed up here when you did this, and everything. So we were, reverential at points, but other points we were definitely, willing to kick him to the curb a little bit when he deserved it. And I think that was, for me, was like finishing this book. We were so wrapped up in it for a long period of time, and we got a little bit manic towards the end, and everything, meeting our deadline. And you kind of lose sight of what you've done and everything. And I think that was part of the process. Again, like you mentioned, Brad and I were just, constantly criticizing each other on various points and everything like that. And then we walked away from it for a while. And my initial thing as a writer is always like, okay, I've done this stuff and I don't really like to go back and read what I've done in the past, and everything. I'm always moving on to the next thing. And we had to kind of go back and read this to do some proofreading and everything with that, with the book company. And I was reading it, and I mean, it sounds egotistical, but I was like, hey, I like this, I actually like this book, it's like, wow, I didn't realize that, we did this, and you kind of forget. And it's like, if I entertained myself, I guess I did a good job here. So, and it's kind of nice to see the wider world accepting it. We're going to get some reviews and everything that aren't going to be 100% glowing, but they kind of roll off our back because I feel some confidence in this, and it's it really is, something that we're both very proud of, and we're glad that to get that, that something like that acknowledgement is just means a lot to us.
Well, well deserved. Thank you again, both, for your time. I really appreciate it, and wish you all the best on the future success of the book.
Cool.
Great interview, Chad. Thank you.
Yes, very much so. Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation with Brad Tilinski and Chris Gill discussing their new book, Blow by Blow, The Jeff Beck Story. The book is out now wherever books are sold, You can find out more about the book at dacapopress.com. You can find out more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, we'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson.